Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening to the show, friends. I do appreciate it as always. Brian Diaz here with you. And we're going to do something a little different here on the NOLA Drink Show, friends. If you regularly listen on the radio, then you miss our podcast-only segment called Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, always a bit of fun, extended conversation that we have. So what you're going to hear today, if you're listening on the radio, are a couple segments that we pulled from recent shows that are our podcast-only, again, Another Shot with NOLA Drinks segments. The first one, we're going to be over at Latitude 29, talking with Jeff Beachbum Berry and Brad Smith. And Jeff Beachbum Berry is, of course, the proprietor and tiki cocktail historian, along with Brad Smith, who is his general manager and head bartender. Now, we recorded this during the holidays recently. So the first few minutes, we talk about a drink program called Sippin' Santa. But then we quickly move on to understanding the Planner's Punch, the complicated history of that drink, talking about the allspice spice and its influence and role in tiki cocktails. A really, really interesting conversation to understand the template for tiki cocktails. We do that first, and then we are over at Old Rail Brewing Company talking with our beer experts Sal Mortellaro and Matt Horney, and we did a show reviewing sort of the year in beer that was in 2019, and what we talk about in the Another Shot segment, largely just ideas that we think trends we're going to see in 2020 and some other considerations. So really interesting stuff there if you're interested in beer. If you are listening on the radio, go get the podcast. Go to our website, noladrinks.com. You'll find it on your favorite platform. Links are there to subscribe and all that good stuff, because we are going to be tacking on another shot with NOLA Drinks. Stay with me there, that you maybe didn't hear. So if you do listen to the podcast, maybe you heard these, but if you missed these are really great. If you're listening on the radio, gives you an opportunity to hear stuff you've not heard before. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to be back chatting with Brad Smith and Jeff Beachbum Berry about tiki stuff. And then after the bottom of the hour break, we're going to be back talking about beer with Sal and Matt. Come on back. Laissez le bon temps brûler. Hey, Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. From the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party comes the 4th Annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 11th through the 14th. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food, all at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much, much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown Foreman, Uncle Nearest, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com. All right, everybody, have another shot with NOLA Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in. Friends, as always, we're here at Latitude 29 chatting with Jeff Beachbum Berry and Brad Smith. And thanks again, guys, for having us here.
Thanks for coming. It's always a pleasure.
It's always a lot of fun. Good to have you. Almost survived the first experience on the show.
Almost.
We're not quite done yet.
So you still got 10 minutes.
Yeah, the tides could still turn here.
There's plenty of time.
So far, so good, man.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, you guys. And we talked a lot about the Sippin' Santa program and a really great cocktail program. You know, one thing I didn't ask you guys in the radio portion, can people find out, like, what other bars are participating in the program for all of our out-of-the-area
listeners? Oh, for sure. Absolutely, yeah. Sippin' Santa, just Google Sippin' Santa online, and or Beachbum Berry Sippin' Santa. Yeah. And they have the website has a thing for all 27 locations, the one nearest you.
Okay.
You
know? Very cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. And it continues to grow every year, right? More bars kind of sign on. And
so far, so good, man. Yeah.
Do you guys kind of go through a process when do you look at the bars and are these people you have relationships with? Or I'm assuming that you're not just going to have anybody participate, right?
No. The whole thing is, Cocktail Kingdom is very, very selective. And they will go to a bar and they'll check it out and see what the cocktail list looks like and see if they could handle our recipes, and not that it's like that, it's not like it's rocket science or anything, but is this a bar that can do cocktails and do them right? Mm-hmm. And is the staff cool and friendly, and is it going to be a good vibe and all that? And once they're vetted, then they're invited to participate. And some bars say, well, no, we do just fine during Christmas, we don't need to pay you the X amount of dollars to be part of this. But other bars go, yeah, that's kind of a maybe we can use a bump, so and this looks cool, so they participate, and it's like it's a win-win for a lot of bars, like particularly us. Like it just is a really good boost for us in December before the big tourist season kicks in, you know, because mm-hmm. we're in the quarter, we're very dependent on all that, and it gets people, it gets locals into the quarter, you know, right. which is less and less of a necessity for them now, because there's all kinds of great places opening up in all the different, you know, neighborhoods. So you don't have to go into the quarter anymore. Time was, even as short ago as we opened, like five, six years ago, quarter
yeah.
was it if you wanted to go have a good drink mm-hmm. or a good meal. But now, you know, there are places uptown, places in Bywater, places in Mid-City. You don't really have to drive into the quarter and try to find a parking spot anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, so something like Sippin' Santa is a good boost for us because, like, you know, that'll get people out of their neighborhoods.
And it's something different, right? I'm assuming maybe for you sure. guys, Brad, it's kind of fun. I know it's a lot of work to get it off the ground every year, but, you know, just kind of mix things up a little bit.
It is, but it also, like Jeff had mentioned earlier in the radio segment, when we do like a happy hour, we are used to the idea of creating bespoke menus that are only going to last for a certain amount of time. There's ingredients involved with it that aren't part of our normal cocktail list. So the work that goes into it is something that we're intimately familiar with. So mm-hmm. it's, even though it is a lot of work, it's not something that is new to us at all. And I will talk about, I think the way that this has been grown has been so measured and calculated. Like, we could probably sell Sippin' Santa to hundreds of bars across the world. Mm-hmm. Like, it really would be no issue whatsoever. But the fact that Cocktail Kingdom does take this approach of making sure that the bars that take this on will do the cocktails justice.
Honor the concept.
Yep. Okay. And have the talent and the wherewithal to actually execute it properly. Mm-hmm. I think that sort of measured approach is fantastic. I mean, you look at their other pop-up, the Miracle on 5th, and how they have slowly grown that the same way. I think it says a lot. So, yeah. You know, we've got 27 this year. Next year, who
put
knows?
A zero on it.
Yeah. Who knows?
Who knows?
Right. But it won't grow like crazy. It'll grow exactly the way that it needs to.
Right.
Organic.
Got it.
Organic.
Yeah.
Organic.
Yeah. Yep. And we'll make sure that no matter who takes it on, they can actually do it and do it justice.
And do it justice. Yeah. Cool. Let me ask you guys this. It's kind of a shifting of gears here, fellas. But we took a break from the show last week because of the holiday when people are hearing this. In the previous show, the Planner's Punch came up, and I sort of referred to the drink, this particular show. You can go back and find it yourself. I'm not going to name names. It's public. But thank you, Matt. So I said it was kind of a murky cocktail because I think a lot of things have been called the Planner's Punch, especially way back when, as far as the very specific ingredients that were in it. And I kind of got a little pushback on that because they were trying to talk about the brands that they use in their Planner's Punch. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it like that. What is that drink?
Well, that's a 90-minute seminar I've been doing.
Okay, yeah.
But
about pushing products, Brad. Yes. Jeez, man.
Yeah, that's what I've been going around the country talking about for the last couple of years. And the reason why I can do 90 minutes about this one drink is that this is the cocktail. This is the big bang of tiki. Mm-hmm. This is the drink on which every famous tiki drink is based on. That's the template. That's the formula. And it's sweet, sour, strong, and weak. And it's three. It's the first mixed drink. It's like over 300 years old. It starts off in the 17th century, in the mid-1600s in Southeast Asia, when the British East India Company and the Dutch East India Company were kind of like, these weren't just corporations. They had their own private armies, basically, and they were strip mining the Malay Archipelago and the Spice Islands of their nutmeg and cinnamon and tea and sugar and all these things that the old world was not privy to. They brought the recipe for punch, which originated in Southeast Asia, back to England and Amsterdam and Lisbon and all the great port cities of Europe. And the punch basically... punch is a corruption of the word paunch, P-A-U-N-C-H, which is also a corruption of the Sanskrit word paunch for five.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that's the five ingredients to go into punch from the 17th century, which is sugar, water, spirit, spice, and tea. So from this, which used to be served in big 4 or 5 quart punch bowls, for, and it was a 200-year vogue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When punch hit Europe, it was 200 years. That's a lot longer than the Cosmo trend. You know, this is actually a huge cocktail trend. And, you know, using various things as the spirit, you know, first it was cognac or sometimes gin in Holland. Once rum became big in the 1650s, that became what they used. You know, the spirits varied, the citrus varied, but...
So citrus was kind of introduced later then, right?
Well, from citrus was always a part of it. If I messed that up on the five, citrus was part of the five.
Okay.
I've been drinking, and it's actually citrus in the drink, too, oddly enough. because this drink, the Christmas Eve of Destruction, is a Planet's Punch variation, as are all, as is a zombie, as are
right,
all famous.
Right.
Anyway, getting back to the old world, punch was a 200-year vogue. A whole culture grew up around it. And eventually, when the Industrial Revolution happens in the 19th century, punch goes from being a 4 or 5 quart bowl that was drunken leisurely over the course of an evening in little cups to a single serving drink, because this is the age of the cocktail. Punch is sort of a quaint, pokey affair, very time-consuming to make and to drink. Now that the entire world is becoming mechanized and, you know, coal trains are replacing mule trains and steamships are replacing clipper ships, the world's moving too fast for that. Mm-hmm. And the cocktail comes into vogue. It's a short drink, single-serving drink, quickly made, quickly drunk.
Mm-hmm.
And the Planner's Punch recipe gets reduced down to sweet, sour, strong, and weak in a tall glass.
What is the weak at that point?
The weak is water or ice.
Ice.
By the Industrial Revolution,
water.
Of course, you have ice. But
okay.
Traditionally, going back to the 1600s, it was sugar, citrus, spirit, and water.
Right. Okay.
And then, of course, a touch of spice to make it nice, as mm-hmm. the Jamaicans say. So this drink, the Planner's Punch, and the classic example is a half an ounce of lime juice, an ounce of, two tablespoons sugar, an ounce of sugar, one part lime, two parts sugar, three parts strong, which would be a good dark Jamaican punch rum, four mm-hmm. parts weak, which could be water or tea.
Okay.
And then a little bit of nutmeg or apple or Angostura bitters on top, you know, touch of spice,
touch of spice.
Nice. That very, very simple template was what Don the Beachcomber, who single-handedly created the tiki drink and the tiki bar, took in 1934 and turned into what he called rum rhapsodies and what we call tiki drinks, which are basically all turbocharged Planner's Punches. 33 of the original 70 drinks on his menu, the menu that was copied by hundreds of copycats over the years and created the 40-year tiki golden age from the 1930s to the 70s, they were all based on the Planners. And what he did was he multiplied each line of that poem. So instead of just lime, it would be lime and, well, what if we did lime and grapefruit? Instead of just sugar, it was like, what if we infuse our sugar with cinnamon? And what if we add pomegranate to that? And what if we put falernum on top of that, which is already a compound syrup with a bunch of different things in it? And Don's real genius was in the strong aspect. Like, why just a dark Jamaican punch rum? What if we cut that with a lighter, more floral, drier Puerto Rican rum? The two rums inform each other, create something better in the glass than either one of them, better than some of their parts. Then throw another curveball on that, give it a top note of like an overproof Demerara rum from Guyana, which has a charred wood, smoky, burnt taste, which adds another layer. So what one rum can't give you, basically, three rums maybe can.
And that's a unique thing with tiki, isn't it, Jeff?
Very
that we're
unique.
Talking about
and
having multiple
today,
high-proof spirits.
Yeah. And the same thing with the weak. You know, it's like... instead of water or tea, we'll put a little pineapple in there or, you know, some other, or guava or passion fruit or what have you. And that's basically, so anytime anybody asks you what a tiki drink is a Planner's Punch cubed or squared. You know, it's just like, and every element of that poem, that four-line poem, has been dimensionalized.
Got it.
And Planner's Punch now, to bring back to your original statement, has been corrupted. There's nothing quite as good as a traditional Planner's Punch at a certain time of day in certain weather. Just lime, spirit, sugar, and ice. I mean, that's what I make at home now. You know, I don't make zombies at home, but I'll make a Planner's Punch.
Right, right.
And it's the reason why it lasted for 350, going on 400 years. And it's been corrupted from a drink into a drink category.
Okay.
If you order a Planner's Punch in most of the Caribbean now, ironically enough, you're going to get You know, there's like grenadine, pineapple, pomegranate, all kinds of stuff just randomly thrown in there with whatever syrup, whatever spirit you have. And but there's the nice, clean, basic tiki template of that those four ingredients is an awesome drink.
You know? That's amazing. Yeah, thank you for sharing that because I think a lot of people expect a Planter's Punch to be like Hawaiian punch and a bunch of
right, a bright red, sugary, slushy drink. That's simply not the case. Yeah. But you know, cast out of the bag. There's not much you can do about it now. You know, just like
name's not copyrighted, right? Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you guys one last question, then we're going to let you go because Latitude 29 is open for business. We want to make sure that people get the hospitality they deserve here. Brad, you mentioned allspice dram, or allspice, I should say, not dram, being a key ingredient in tiki, and something I know I'd mentioned to Jeff before. This is some years ago when I was at a tiki bar in the Bay Area who shall remain unnamed because they don't give proper credit to drinks. We're going to leave it at that. But that to me, was like a touchstone moment for me in my tiki experience because I was tasting a Navy grog.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's that flavor that I had had a handful of times going back in San Francisco at Vic's and things like that. That to me is such a key ingredient. What do you think of allspice dram or allspice and... To me, it is like a touchstone kind of thing for tiki in a lot of ways. Not in every drink, but
it kind of goes like to what Jeff was saying about the Planter's Punch, where you have your basic ingredients, but there is a spice element that can be added. And I think with a Navy Grog, it is absolutely essential because a Navy Grog is one of the driest tiki drinks that's out there. Mm-hmm. Without the allspice, I personally do not find that drink to be remarkable. I think that it is fine. But it's very dry, it's very acidic. But when you add that just that hint of allspice over the top of it, it changes it. It makes it into magic.
Because otherwise that cocktail it's just boozy and citrusy.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, that's it. It is a traditional, it's a variation on the Planter's Punch. But mm-hmm. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. But when you add the allspice to that, that takes it to some other level that's just... Beyond compare.
Even when you dash it in the way you might a bitters, just a little bit, you know, just it's like it just transforms the drink.
It's truly.
And sometimes truly that's all you need. I've been to a lot of bars where they use allspice like cocktail duct tape, you know, and it's just like they'll just use it to fix anything because that flavor is so great.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You know, and just like pour it onto everything and, okay, you got a decent drink now. You know, it's the same way that people used to use ginger beer or elderflower liqueur.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I think with our Navy Grog, though, we do dash it in. Yeah. It is very, very carefully measured. Mm-hmm. It's not used as duct tape. It's used as an essential ingredient in that wonderful
cocktail. It can become overwhelming. It's one of those ones that too little doesn't show and too much shows too much,
right? In the case of our grog, if you don't know what allspice is and you've never had it before, you're not going to know that that's what is making that drink special. But if it's not in the drink, you'd miss it. You know?
Right. For sure. That's a good way to put it. And that's actually kind of why I had that sort of moment is that it came together when the bartender told me what that flavor was in the drink.
Yeah.
And I had no clue. And then they pulled out the bottle. I think it was St. Elizabeth's, I'm guessing.
I think there's a thing about allspice that sort of mimics some of the notes that you pull out of a barrel when you age rum. Mm-hmm. And I think that the spiciness is kind of like there's a char thing to it. There's sort of a burnt wood. You know, right. So when it's used appropriately, it's almost like adding age and characteristic to a rum that wouldn't ordinarily be there.
That's a good way to put it.
But it has to be used so gingerly and particularly. Mm-hmm. But when it's done right.
That's a really good way to put it, Brad, because we sort of talk about in those baking spice notes that are on it, when you get that kind of finish, say, on a properly well-made bourbon, that same kind of idea where you get that baking spice note.
There's a way to mimic some of those aged characteristics with things like allspice or even with the Sip and Santa, like with nutmeg or with our ginger amaro. Like some of those things are just, when they're used appropriately, it just accentuates the spirit and the age of the spirit.
Awesome. You guys, Brad, tell people one more time where they can find Latitude 29 on the street and online.
320 Decatur here in New Orleans. Latitude29NewOrleans.com.
All right. And Jeff, your website for wares and books and such?
Yes, beachbumberry.com. And the restaurant, separate from that, Latitude29NOLA.com.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
Thanks. All right, everybody can take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to be back talking beers with Sal and Matt. Come on back. All right, everybody. Another shot with Noel Drinks. Thanks for listening in. We are talking about beer, and I think we want to put a few closing points or finer points on what we were talking about, guys, here with 2019, and we kind of bolted through a few things in talking about the last year about beer growth, craft beer growth still continuing, summarizing here, of course, a bit, alcohol being flat, overall beer sales being down a bit. But let's talk a little bit, you guys, about the underpinnings. I did mention the idea that 25% of younger drinkers were drinking 25% less than the same age group 25 years ago, for all three of those 25s. So I think we are seeing people drink less, but maybe better. People are drinking less on balance. There are some health considerations and things like this. But Matt, you were saying something before we went on the air, talking about a generational consideration, mm-hmm. which I think you raised a really good point yeah. that we all kind of want to do different than the previous generation.
Yeah, this was from an article that I was reading either, I think it was this morning or yesterday. And it kind of goes into the context of that your father's generation is something that you want to do different than. And when you kind of put this in perspective, if your father's generation is the 60s, 70s, Miller Lite, Budweiser, you know, Coors drinker, now we have the craft beer movement from the next generation. So now that this generation that started the craft beer movement is now growing up,
I think you're talking about sort of my generation growing up in, you know, being a teenager, young adult in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. So that original craft beer movement of the Sierra Nevadas and the pyramids and things like that, that's sort of what we're talking about here. Oh, thank you very much. Step on it. Thank you. Kind stuff coming from the kitchen here from the chef. I think we have some buffalo oysters here, don't we?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. So we'll give a plug here out to chef in just a second. But so, yeah, I think, you know, we had that original craft movement. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of worth talking about this briefly because we had a blow up of sort of an earlier craft or small brewery movement in the late 80s and early 90s. Mm-hmm. And that tanked early to mid 90s.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, we wanted to do... So that was my generation or my original experience with smaller beers.
Yeah. So it kind of, like, it started a spark. The spark didn't really take so much as much as everybody probably would have liked it to. But then in the 90s, like, the home brewing, you know, the Zymergy magazine came out, the BYO kind of stuff started, the Homebrewers Association became more vocalized. So things started kind of changing in the 90s. And then as we move into the 2000s, it's like the homebrewers were kind of booming. The BJCP really kind of took off. And, you know, competitions start flourishing, you know.
More food coming in from the kitchen.
So you get these kind of like, I think they're kind of, you know, changes in I don't know, generations. But where this goes from here is going to be the interesting thing, because now as we have the millennial generation, which has proven to be drastically different than anything previous, what are they going to choose? Where is it going to go? And it seems to be going towards craft cocktails and hard seltzers and things like that. And then you see these numbers where, you know, consumption's declined, but what's it declining from? You know, is it the taste of alcohol? Is it just spirits in general, beer in general, or is it that is it money? You know, is it any of these things, or just selecting, being more selective, paying more money for something and drinking less of it?
Do you think? And Sal, feel free to chime in here too. I think you've touched on a lot of the key factors. I think it's probably multiple, right? In that we do talk about money expenditure, disposable income, people being perhaps cautious with that on some levels. I think we talk about, as we spoke about, drinking less but drinking better. We have arguably nearly 8,000 breweries now just in the United States alone. But what we're also seeing is we're seeing a greater diversification of what's available on the market. We have SKUs and SKUs and SKUs of beers available competing for shelf space. We also have a significant growth in the number of wineries in the country and globally, and we also have a significant growth in the spirits category. And I think that what we probably had back in, you know, decades ago, two, three, four decades ago, especially before the craft cocktail movement and the blow up of smaller wineries maybe 30 years ago, is people were drinking, I drink beer, I drink wine, I drink cocktails. People are drinking across categories more.
Yeah.
And we're also seeing more and more craft spirits being made.
mm-hmm. Both in the United States and more things that are being imported that disappeared, used to be available from Europe, or new stuff coming in from Europe and the old world. So simply that there's a much greater choice, and I think people are drinking across categories more.
Well, and you wonder, too, because...
And I'm going to eat with my fingers. Go on, Sal, sorry. Yeah.
You wonder, too, because as people's palates become more educated on what constitutes a good drink or a good cocktail, people know good beer, people know good wine, and I think that it kind of opens the door to exploration, to seeing what's out there. Maybe that may be part of what we're seeing with this. People are drinking more across the board as a whole.
That makes sense. Let's talk about this, you guys. Sorry, because we're eating some really delicious food. Give shout out to Chef here.
Oh, yeah.
Because he brought us some really good food.
So Chef Brett, he does a great job with the food here. And we occasionally will do beer dinners, and that's when he really gets to shine and kind of do the cool stuff. And he does some really great food during these beer dinners that we'll put on.
Well, so getting back to the beer thing, so I think we talked about a lot of diversification. We talk about multiple SKUs. We talk about different choices, people drinking less, people drinking better, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. We've had more of a trend also towards local, mm-hmm. I think, and drinking local mm-hmm. has coming back a lot more. How does that affect things, Matt? And do you think that, you know, in regards to tap rooms and the role that tap rooms play, mm-hmm. because I think some people think that tap rooms are causing competition for retailers, and that gives them some pause that, like, mm-hmm. you know, that kind yeah. of thing going on. And then I think other people, yeah. it drives innovation, and mm-hmm. it's not really competition. It's brand building.
It's interesting. There's a lot of different avenues that this can go down. And as a brewpub brewer, a tap room does become direct competition with me. It becomes direct competition with, you know, a craft beer bar. You know, we have one down the street that, and, you know, for full disclosure, that's a sister bar of ours. But at the same time, you know, at first I was like, you know, well, they get the choice to distribute. They get the choice to do these things. We don't even get the choice, but they can compete directly with us. They can have televisions, they can have food, they can act as like a full on restaurant almost. And you know, that as a brewer in my setting, restricted, it gets a little frustrating. Would I restrict what they do? Absolutely not. You know, I would like to see these things, and I wouldn't take anything away from anybody. I just want to see more growth and more opportunity. But the tap rooms as a whole, if I was going to open something, I would definitely go tap room route and no distribution. I think a neighborhood little jaunt, a good neighborhood craft beer place to go to is super valuable. And I think more and more places, you know, larger cities, you know, look at Atlanta there. I have a bunch of friends that are just opening up some stuff. Probably three of my friends opened up three breweries this fall. But they're all local. They're not going anywhere outside of that region, outside that city. It's all just for those people. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that. I think that's going to be more of a trend, in cities. Maybe it'll start pushing out into smaller towns. You'll start seeing more craft breweries in small towns. And that, as a whole, when you add all of those people up together, is going to be the major major competition for some of the larger breweries like the Budweisers and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I think the niche neighborhood little nook is the trend.
Okay. Mm. Sal, do you want to add to that? I haven't asked you specifically for, and we'll get to this, the, you know, so-called bold predictions for 2020. But do you want to add to what we're talking about here with the, pardon me, with the tap room consideration and the role that that plays versus breweries that sell in an on-premise and off-premise situation?
I do agree with Matt. If I was to do it, I would definitely open up a local tap room only kind of thing. The fact that you have more creativity, that you have a direct customer base, like a local customer base, you can maintain a great following as long as you put out a great product. You can establish a very great and a very consistent following of customers. That's really the way to go. There's a few places that are opening up right now around the Baton Rouge area that are going to be taproom local only. There's three or four that are opening up right now or in the midst of opening up that are going to be taproom only. And that's kind of one of the things I see with Louisiana, it seems. A lot of people are trying to get away from that distribution model
right?
Mm-hmm. And go with the on-premise tap room.
Well, let me ask you, and we're kind of touching on this, but let me ask you to sort of react to this quote, because some people, I think, are, you know, they're sort of threatened by the tap room sort of model here. And the guy who runs Dogfish Head, Caglione. Caglione, excuse me. He says, quote, "I worry that the category," referring to tap rooms, "I worry that the category is trapped in the smiling jaws of death, where the taproom model is the bottom jaw and the top jaw is the top 50 breweries. Remember, well over half of the volume of these top breweries comes from producers outside of the craft trade associations. They're former craft breweries that have been bought out by global companies." What are your reactions to that, Matt? I mean, there's a truth that like a lot of these guys are marketing themselves as craft, but they've been bought by AB InBev and things like that.
I think what he says has some merit to it, but I think when what the larger breweries have done is basically they still haven't really changed anything, because what they're going for is whatever's going to be on the store shelf in your grocery store. That's not necessarily a bike ride down the street to your local pub or your brew pub or, you know, tap room. And, you know, people aren't dumb. You know, they'll go to a city meeting when somebody's going to open something, and they'll go and learn about it, and, you know, they'll find out who's behind it. So if AB InBev is going to start opening up a small craft tap room in a town, you know, I don't know how the laws really factor in on that, because there are laws between distribution breweries and tap rooms.
Certainly in Louisiana, they can't.
Right, but yeah. So I don't know if they would actually be able to pull that off. But what they're shooting for in that market, I don't think they can actually achieve, because it's something so unique and so specific to an individual owner and that community link that I don't think they can actually achieve that. Now, if you want to emulate a craft brewery and buy one and put the product in a Publix or a Kroger or whatever it is, that's a different story. And I don't think that, I think that market's going to evolve and it's going to change. And I don't think it's always going to be the same. But I do think, you know, the market for an independent brewer is going to, I think there's more value in that as a whole.
Okay.
You might not make a whole lot of money doing it, but it depends what makes you happy.
Okay, and do you think his point, because, and I think we should be clear too, because Dogfish Head merged or was acquired by Boston Beer, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Which is Sam Adams.
Yeah, and I like when they announced that they considered it a merger. It was very specific in their wording on that. That wasn't a buyout, it wasn't a takeover, it was a merger. So that was interesting.
Right. Mm-hmm. More or less a takeover by Boston Beer, correct?
Yeah, and I, you know, it was kind of interesting, because when I was at the Craft Brewers Conference, Sam Caglione was talking with the brewmaster at Rodenbach, and they were actually collaborating. It was the first collaboration that Rodenbach had ever done. And, you know, it was a big talk on Dogfish Head doing this and this and this and how this is great for craft beer. And then, you know, here we are 6 months later finding out, or whatever it was at the time, that, you know, they were getting bought.
Right, getting bought.
That was, I don't know what Rodenbach thought about that.
Right.
All right, everybody, going to take a brief break here on the show in the middle of this interesting beer conversation, and we're going to be right back on the other side of the break, finishing up things with Matt and Sal, talking beer, and close out the radio portion of the show. Come on back. Now, if you ever been down to New... Laissez le bon temps brûler. Hey, Brian Diaz here with the NOLA Drink Show. From the city that shares a deep connection to bourbon and knows how to throw a party, comes the 4th Annual New Orleans Bourbon Festival from March 11th through the 14th. Discover over 150 bourbons and American whiskeys, as well as great food, all at the Grand Tasting. Check out more than 30 seminars led by industry luminaries, special distiller dinners, and much, much more. The event is brought to you by Beam Suntory, Four Roses, Brown Foreman, Uncle Nearest, and the Hilton Riverside. More info and tickets at nobourbonfest.com.
So, bold predictions for 2020, buddy.
I think there will be laws when drinking White Claws.
You think there will be laws?
When drinking White Claws.
Or is this going to turn into a wrap of some sort?
No, apparently there's no claw when you're drinking. No law when you're drinking White Claw.
Oh, okay.
So I think there will be laws when drinking White Claw.
Okay.
You
got anything else beyond that?
No. I was joking, of course, but I really do think.
I didn't know where to go with that.
I really do think you're not hip with the memes.
I'm so not hip with the memes.
I really do think we
see the Baby Yoda with the White Claw, though. Did you see that?
No, I did.
Oh, it's a thing now. Like, yeah, okay, that's phenomenal. Don't mean to distract you. Go on.
I do think they're called malt-ternatives, is what they're called. And I do think we will see a rise in malt-ternatives. We will see that. Things we talked about, I think we will see a rise in non-alcoholic beer. In lagers, I think we're going to see those trends continue to push into 2020.
Okay. Anything else you got more bold than just continuing trends?
I can't think of it off the top of my head, but okay. I'm really looking forward to seeing what new styles emerge. You see a lot of these guys throwing lactose to the point where a lot of them are ridiculously sweet, almost cloying. Quote-unquote IPAs, which, of course, is a contradiction in and of itself, a sweet IPA.
So explain that, because this is a bold prediction. This is what I want to hear.
Yeah, so, the kind of the hallmark of the IPA, the India Pale Ale, are these medium-high to high bitter beers. That is the point of the style. And it's just so bizarre to see that people come in with these New England IPAs, and they call them New England IPAs, or it's whatever type of IPA, and they add lactose to them. That seems to be a bit of a trend right now. So I'm kind of curious to see how things like that pan out. We talked about the emergent IPAs. IPA, yeah. I really kind of want to see what's going to happen.
Okay.
These contradiction of styles are weird. It's kind of like saying, here's a bitter barley wine. It's like, wait, what? The barley wine's a malt-forward sweet style. What did you just do? So I'm really kind of curious to see how people push these envelopes.
Okay, so pushing the envelopes and sort of breaking down these barriers of categories.
Correct.
And Matt, I'll ask you to give if you have any predictions, but doesn't a tap room in this kind of situation, this is the laboratory for that type of stuff to happen, right?
I mean, I've always kind of wanted just to brew a beer and throw a recipe together the day that I brewed. And just order yeast and just have it here and just throw something together and see what it comes out like. And just, you know, maybe it might be the bitter barley wine. I don't know. But, like, what hops do I have that I have opened right now that I just want to get rid of? Yeah. Let's just throw them in there and see what happens. No, I don't know. But it is. It is. And, you know, the cool thing about what we do here, since we don't have to depend on some of the requirements of a distributor telling us that we need to meet this like distribution goal. If I decide that I'm going to brew like our New England IPA, and then I decide, you know, the day that I'm going to brew it, that I have a couple extra bags of this malt and I just got this hop order in, I'm just going to create a new IPA that day because I'm not bound by a distribution thing where I have to meet somebody's requirements. So
and fit it in their SKU.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I can just create a new one. And we've done that with some beers. We've just altered things and changed things. And when you taste it, you know, you decide, this is a new beer. Well, we have to come up with a new name now. So, it's kind of cool to be able to do that.
Cool. Mm-hmm. And anything else you got that you want to throw out there? Put yourself on the line.
On the line? I did read this article. Virgin Galactic was supposed to, they're coming up with this new way of space travel, where they're just going to go straight up into space and come straight down, and within like a half hour you could be in Europe. So what I'm hoping for in 2020 is that I can get to Munich in a half an hour, have a beer, and get back before my lunch is over.
That's a bold prediction. And actually bring fresh beers back
right.
that don't taste the same after right. they've spent, 3 months coming across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
Or that, 3 weeks.
Well, maybe that'll change the way beer distribution happens. I don't know.
That's a bold. That is
send it to space and bring it back down.
Bold prediction. Well, that creates a whole different aging consideration in zero gravity. Right. Yeah. Zero gravity beer. Okay, this is bold prediction 2026.
New trend.
New trend.
Yeah.
You heard it here first, friends, on the NOLA Drink Show. Matt, tell one more time before we get into the food that the chef brought us. Where do we find Old Rail Brewing Company?
We're on 639 Gerard Street, Old Mandeville, just east of the Causeway.
Awesome. BJCP, buddy?
BJCP.org. Find them on Facebook. Find them on the internet. And that's it. Learn how to judge. Come out, judge competitions. Read the beer guidelines. The whole bit.
And we may find you behind the bar at Grateful Ape and Old Mandeville.
You may find me behind the bar at Grateful Ape.
That's a topic Sling
and
for
drinks.
Another time.
Sling and cocktails. Drinks.
Guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening to the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it. As always, if you're listening on the podcast, we got one more to go. And if you're listening on the radio, well, I encourage you to go get the podcast, as we say. Go check out NOLADrinks.com. You'll find it there. But again, if you are listening on the radio, we'll be back with a new show next week. Remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers, y'all. Everybody, hey, yep, another shot with NOLA Drinks. I guess that's maybe a little redundant because this whole show was, what are we calling it? I don't, maybe we'll come up with a better name. Best of another shot with NOLA Drinks. That's what I've got so far. Didn't have a lot of imagination at this point, but the whole idea is to bring you something that you may have missed in our podcast only segment called Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, or something that you just want to hear again because it was so damn interesting. I'd like to think it's mostly the latter. Anyway, we have another one here coming up for you, and when we were putting the radio show together, the radio portion of the show earlier, I didn't know exactly what the third segment was going to be that we were going to use, and so that's why I didn't say what it was. But what we're doing here with this one coming up is a conversation that we had about 2-3 months ago with two of the most noted bartenders, excuse me, on the face of the earth, Dale DeGroff and Julie Reiner. And that was our podcast only another shot segment connected to a show that was largely about women in spirits, and we focus on some of those topics about women in the industry, the importance of inclusivity in the industry, both behind the bar as well as in the distilling world. So really, really interesting conversation with great perspective from both Dale and Julie. So we got that coming up for you, and then I'll be back to close things out briefly with the parting shot. Here we go. Yep, another shot with NOLA Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you, friends. Thanks for listening in this week. As always, we're chatting with Dale DeGroff and Julie Reiner. And we're talking about Marie Brizard a little bit, some of the spirits they have, the cocktail competition that they sponsored during Tales of the Cocktail just this past July. We tasted through a few expressions. And, you know, part of the idea or part of the impetus for the cocktail competition was the contestants were asked to make a drink based on a female that inspired them, either maybe directly in their lives or historically or something like that. And we were talking, you know, a little bit, part of the theme here that we want to cover is talking about women in the spirits world, women in the industry. Marie Brizard, I think, is an interesting story, maybe even as a starting point, for lack of a better way to put it. And then moving forward to the landscape today. Do you guys want to kind of jump in there? I mean, and take a sort of historical journey. Dale, do you want to start with that? Yeah, go ahead.
There's for the first time in there are numbers of female master distillers, which just was not the case, you know, 50 years ago or 30 years ago. And now there are multiple brands that have women at the helm and when it comes to the distilling world, and that's a huge change.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sea change. And I described earlier about women in Midtown Manhattan or in any fancy hotel bar around the country, for that matter. You wouldn't see a woman behind that bar. There was a woman behind a fancy bar, the Savoy Hotel, way back at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. And, you know, I think it was American businessmen who were going over there doing business internationally, finally, who complained to the hotel managers that they thought it was inappropriate for this woman to be behind the bar. And don't you know, they fired her.
Wow. I had not heard that story.
That's something. Yeah. It was Harry Craddock who took over her for her, an American bartender, in exile, by the way, but from Prohibition. Mm-hmm. She had been working there for years when he came along, and she was kind of replaced by Harry. And it had to do with certain guests, most of them Americans, making complaints to the management that they thought it was inappropriate for a woman to be in the barroom.
This is something, I mean, that's really interesting to hear, and I never heard that part of the story before from the bar. Is it something where, how shall I phrase this question? When we look at, say, like Marie Brizard and that story of the brand that, you know, dates back to the 18th century, is this a little bit of a whitewashing of history? Are we not? Are we starting to dig deeper and discover that there was a far greater involvement of women in the spirits world, in the cocktail world? It just kind of was ignored historically?
Or? Oh, I would believe so. Don't you think, too? Well, Madame Clicquot, I mean, she was the boss of Beau Clicquot.
Right.
You know, there must be. I know that in the world of literature, you know, women had to use men's names to write. So yeah, they had a terrific presence. It turns out that some of the great composers' wives were also pretty amazing musicians.
Great composers,
you know,
exactly.
Much about that either.
Right, right. What do you think, Julie?
What they did.
Oh, go ahead, Dale. Or Julie.
No.
I was going to say also, you know, it's like you look at during World War II, you know, World War One, like women took over for the jobs that a lot of these men, you know, had left to go and fight the wars. And, you know, they were building planes. They were also making cocktails, they were doing all of those things. And then the men came back and said, oh, I'll take my job back and you can go and raise babies again, you know.
Again.
But yeah, I'm here with my mom, who's 93, and she was making machine gun belts.
Oh,
right here in Wesley, Rhode Island, at a textile factory.
Well, yep. Julie, you know, in your case, then, what year did you come into the business, or when did you start bartending?
I started bartending when I was in college,
and this was in Hawaii, correct?
I graduated from high school in Hawaii, and I was cocktail waitressing in bars while I was there.
Okay,
but. The first time, but all of the bartending jobs in Hawaii were, it was all union. It was all men behind the bar. I would look back there and ask them questions, there was, you know, no way I was ever getting behind the bar at any of these places. And then when I went to college, I got a job at a place called The Pub in Tallahassee, Florida, where I went to Florida State University.
Okay.
And that was my first bartending job. So, yeah, I was, you know, 22, the first time I was behind the bar.
Now, and was...
That must have been interesting in that era down there, huh?
Yeah. Is it kind of a college bar kind of scene?
With all the yahoos?
Oh, yeah. This was like beer in a shot. You know, they used to do what they called bladder bust, where it was like free beer until somebody used the bathroom. So all of the football players... Oh, yeah. You can imagine the things that we found at the end of the night.
Oh, goodness.
You know, yeah.
Jeez.
That was not a pitcher of beer.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I should not share this too much out of my past, but there was a 25-cent beer night concept in the early 90s when I was finishing up undergraduate, and we flogged that horse pretty well. So,
yeah.
But go on.
You know, back in the 90s.
It was that kind of a place, and you know, but and so I wasn't making any, you know, anything, any crazy drinks, but it was, yeah, you know, it was, I would make martinis and Manhattans and whiskey and Coke and, you know, all these sort of, you know, highball drinks. But it wasn't a serious cocktail bar by any means, but I certainly realized that I loved being behind the bar.
Okay.
And then I didn't want to leave that position from that.
So was it the drinks, Julie? Was it the hospitality, kind of all of the above, and that piqued your curiosity?
I mean, really a combination. I think what I loved about being behind the bar was that, you know, there was a level of respect that you got from being back there, and you were controlling the flow of alcohol in the room, and therefore, you know, there was the level of respect you got from being on the other side of that piece of wood, you know, as opposed to being on the floor with a tray in your hand, was like night and day. And I had done both, you know, and so I was like, this is where I want to be.
Gotcha. And so then you kind of took the journey to learn the craft of bartending.
I moved out to San Francisco, and I started really learning how to make real cocktails and studying a little bit more. And it really wasn't until I got to New York City that I really took it as seriously as I did, and started, you know, tinkering around with infusions and syrups and that sort of thing. And then I met Dale, and I was like, oh, okay. I would go to events with Dale, and I would just stand and watch him cut a pineapple and be like, oh, that's a much better way to cut a pineapple.
Right.
I just like stand close to Dale, because I never really worked directly with Dale, even though, you know, you read so many articles and they're like, they call me his protege, or they'll say that I was, you know, he was my mentor. And I'm like, he was a mentor, but we actually never worked together. I just would kind of,
I think they're confusing Audrey with you when they say that.
Yeah, they are.
Audrey did in fact work with me.
Yeah. But I would sort of troll Dale while he was prepping and at these events, so I could learn some things.
Gotcha. That's a good, Dale, you're a good person to learn from. So good move there, Julie. Way to glean.
Yep.
So with currently then, I guess we'll kind of fast forward here pretty quickly. You've touched on this. We have touched on this a little bit, how the landscape has changed, where we see more women in master distilling roles. I think we see more women behind the stick in general. We certainly see more women in like a brand ambassador positions and things like that. So the landscape has certainly changed. But, you know, I can, you know, again, speak from the New Orleans perspective. I come from California. I can speak to that perspective a little bit. Sometimes I'm reminded that we're in certain places, we're in a little bit of a bubble, and it maybe seems better than it is. Elaborate on that.
I mean, I have seen it, you know, I mean, the numbers of women in all facets of the spirits industry have certainly increased. You know, but there are still a lot of attitudes and people in, particularly outside of this country, that still hold the views that women don't belong behind bars. A couple of years ago, Charles Schulman, who has received he won Best International Bar this year, and the year before he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award. He came into my bar, he was doing this film, and basically interviewed me and talked to me and told me that he didn't believe that women don't belong behind the bar past 3 p.m.
Oh my goodness.
Because they should be going home to cook dinner for whoever they are cooking dinner for, you know, and I looked at him and it's funny because they've been showing this film on Delta recently, and I've been getting all of these screenshots and people reaching out to me, and they edited out a lot of what I said to him, you know, but I was like, you're standing in a bar that's owned by 3 women, and you're telling me that I don't belong behind my bar past 3 p.m., you know?
Wow.
And this is somebody who, and we're still holding him up and revering him and giving, you know, which makes me scratch my head, you know, that it's, you know, and the attitude, oh, he's just old school. I'm like, if you were to switch women to people of color in that sentence,
right,
it would be an outrage.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. And go on, please.
So yeah, I mean, that's something that you know, it was really eye opening to me, because I felt like we were really making so much headway, and we are. But I think outside of this country and outside of cities that are very forward thinking, and you know, that we have a lot of work to do still.
I hope that you said he's telling you that you don't belong in your bar after 3 p.m. You know, did you say you don't belong in my bar at all, ever?
Oh, it's just women in general. Yeah, it's just like They can work the lunch shift was basically what he was telling
me. Okay.
Yeah. I still find it unbelievable. But yeah, I mean, if you watch the movie, you can see the look on my face when I'm talking to him. Like, really?
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, Dale, since you've been in the industry for a while, what is, you know, your perspective on this? You know, I think when you started, it was definitely more male dominated. What are some of your thoughts?
Well, I mean, as I travel around the country and around the world, I work a lot overseas now. I did 5 cities in Australia this last year, and I made it known to every group of bartenders I spoke to that if you come to New York, you're going to find out that women are running the best bars in the city. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. There's still a little male-dominated down there in Australia, but there are some women behind the bar that are doing amazing things. The attitude changes from owner to owner. You know, it's hard to put a generalization on it. I mean, obviously, sure. If you're going to be in the Middle East or someplace like that, it's going to be all male dominated. But, you know, in most of the sort of Western world, London, France, Amsterdam, even though, you know, there's still some of that left, there's a lot more opportunity for women than there ever was before now. And I see it as a judge also in world class that there's so many more women competing. And you saw that, Julie. So many more women competing than there ever were when I started as a judge in the very first year in London many years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's a very healthy and I've never seen such a community before in this profession. When I was a young bartender in the 70s, there was no community. This was every man for himself, you know. They used to pit bartender against bartender by counting their registers at the end of the shifts. And if your register was $1,000 below the bartender down the bar, then they wanted to know why. And, you know, and if it happened too many times, they were going to find somebody else to run that register. You know, it was a much different world. The community of bartenders today is most extraordinary. I mean, what our friends Ivy Mix and Lynette Moreira are doing with something called Speed Rack, raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for hospitality workers in the breast cancer, suffering from breast cancer. And Tony Abogonin with his charity also doing exactly the same thing. And just the crowd rise things that happen because bartenders don't have any health insurance. You know, a wonderful bartender from Seattle, Washington, I don't want to get into names and stuff, but he was suffering from, he needed a heart transplant, and mm-hmm. he had no health insurance, and within 7 days, Brian,
wow.
$250,000 worldwide in a crowdsource
funding,
website.
Wow.
Unbelievable. I mean, that kind of stuff just didn't happen in the 70s. Well, first of all, there's no internet, but, you know, there was no such thing as that kind of community in this profession.
I think that's a really neat part about it. Yeah, and I think that's a really nice thing that we see in the industry here these days, across all kinds of things. You know, supporting issues in health and wellness in the workspace, safer workspaces, all these other, you know, considerations that you've just touched on, Dale, as well. Let me ask you one last question. I'll direct this to you, Julie, and then I know we got to bounce. I know it's kind of a big question, so I'll kind of try and narrow it down a little bit. As somebody who operates a bar, why does inclusivity matter? Maybe even putting the ethical side away, but from a business perspective, why does that matter to you?
Well, I mean, it's proven that businesses that are more inclusive and both of both gender and race are more successful, you know? Mm-hmm. For me, it's always been about having the most, you know, diverse, wide range of people working within my establishments and giving opportunities to everyone. You know, mm-hmm. if you look around my bars, you see, you know, it's men, women, gay, straight, you know, you name it.
On both sides of the bar, you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. yeah, absolutely. On both sides of the bar and on the floor as well. You know, we try to keep an open mind to anyone who wants an opportunity. So, yeah, you're not going to come into a bar that I'm a part of and see only white men behind the bar.
Right. Got it. Well, thank you. Well, do me a favor really quickly, Dale. Tell us one more time where people can connect with you, the website.
KingCocktail.com.
Perfect. Great. And we'll find. Go ahead.
Oh. No, just one word, KingCocktail.com.
Yeah, KingCocktail.com. And cool, we'll find you gallivanting around the cocktail world as well. And you, Julie, please?
Yeah, CloverClubNY.com, LeandaNY.com, and at MixtressNYC on Instagram.
Excellent. Thanks you two so much for taking some time out today. I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
Oh, it was great fun, Brian.
Thanks. Yeah, we'll have to get together soon.
See you soon, Julie.
See you soon, Dale.
Thanks, y'all. Hey, friends. Brief musical interlude, and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening into the show, friends, this week. I do appreciate it. As always, I hope you enjoyed this little venture that we had, our Best of Another Shot with Nola Drinks segment. And again, like I said just a little while ago, maybe we'll come up with a better name. If you've got an idea, let us know on social media or something like that. That'd be really cool. But the whole idea is that we want to, you know, instead of just kind of running a rerun of a show on the radio, because the radio listeners don't get to hear these podcast-only segments, you who do listen to the podcast get to hear these. So hopefully these were ones that you either got a second chance to hear them and still found them interesting, or it was maybe just something that you missed. And we'll continue to cull some of our favorite ones from time to time when we take a week or two off from doing a new show and go about it this way. A little bit of a programming note that I want to flag to your attention also. We're going to be, we got a new show coming up for you next week. We are chatting with the team from MACNO, which is the Music and Culture Coalition of New Orleans, a really great advocacy and policy organization that seeks to advocate for primarily musicians, but also service industry and other important culture bearers here in New Orleans. We've talked extensively about the importance of tourism to our local economy here in the city and the region, and also then how what really makes up that tourist industry, of course, is largely our cultural capital, our cultural story that we have to tell here. And that's what we generally put front and center to let you know about the city. That's why you come here, right? You want to experience the music, the food, the drink, and so on and so forth. So MACNO is a great organization that does a lot of advocacy. We talk about some recent things going on in the city that I think you'll find very, very interesting. Of course, if you live here, that's probably pretty self-explanatory, but it's important to you if you, you know, are a fan of New Orleans and you plan to visit again, or you plan to visit for the first time, you might go, well, why do we really care about this stuff? Well, it's actually really, really important stuff, because again, why are you coming here to visit from outside the area? You're coming really because of our culture, which is, of course, primarily, it really rests on, again, as I said, the culinary traditions here, the music traditions here, and other aspects of entertainment, street performers, all kinds of stuff that is really the tapestry, as I like to say, of New Orleans. So if we don't have these things going on, if the people that are actually providing the culture, and there's some really interesting dynamics there that we'll discuss on the show, who those people are, where they live, how they're being marginalized. If we don't have those people creating the culture, then we don't have a tourism destination for you to come visit. And we also, as residents, don't really have the substance of the place that we know and love so much. So I hope you can tune in to the show next week and catch that. And so we're just going to kind of call that our parting shot for today, because, you know, we did things a little bit differently, so we might as well keep it that way in the parting shot as well. So friends, that is our parting shot. Here's to you.